Today we're going to cover the book of Joel. At least we'll make hopefully a huge dent in the covering of the book of Joel. If you have your handouts from last time, I'll just go over those with you and highlight some of the areas of concern. As we go through the book of Joel, whose main theme is the day of the Lord and coming judgment. The day of the Lord and coming judgment. You just put the day of the Lord, that's fine. The words day of the Lord are used 5 times in the book. So we can understand that that's a major theme. We don't have any problem with the term day of the Lord except to understand whether he's referring to specific day of the Lord always or whether he's referring to a time when God's going to reckon with them. I think historically he's also prophesying the downfall of Judah, the day when God deals with them. There's no doubt from the context that he's also talking about the future. Now, what we will run into in the way of problems here is trying to figure out who the locusts are. Now, we find locusts used throughout. If you check Revelation chapter 9 on the fifth woe, you have locusts being pictured as the beast power. Now, we know since most of this message is directed to the southern kingdom as opposed to the northern kingdom, since it is directed mostly to the southern kingdom, the terminology here would be saying, hey, the Babylonians are going to come and destroy you. But that's not so much the issue as when you take the word locust and you ask what army is described as locusts, you find it being the fifth woe. Our problem is, though, it also describes this army in chapter 2 as being there's never been the like. So when you look at an army that has never been the like, that is described by the sixth woe. I'm sorry, the second woe. First woe, second woe, the fifth trumpet, the sixth trumpet, not the fifth woe. The first woe, the second woe is equivalent to the sixth trumpet, which pictures the communist oriental hordes. So we have to be careful as we go through here that we don't put down, for instance, in my Bible, I have right at the very beginning the book of Joel where it's describing locusts, I have see the fifth trumpet, or the first woe, and that's describing the beast power that's going to arise out of the bottomless pit. Because they are described as locusts in Revelation chapter 9. I'll go over that with you in a moment. So we do have some problem in the sense of going through the continuity of the book and understanding it from the standpoint of, wait a minute now, historically he's prophesying to the southern kingdom mainly, and therefore he's telling them destruction is going to come upon you just like a literal locust plague has. Right, so now who are these locusts that are going to come through and destroy them when you liken them to actual armies? Well, if it's the southern kingdom, it would be the Babylonians. Might be some hindering from some attacks from the Assyrians, but it's certainly the Assyrians were not the ones that took them into captivity. So here we have the book of Joel being written around 800 A.D., somewhere around in there, if we go with the early dating. We go with a later dating, then we're saying it's almost the aftermath of all the activity, and it's only talking of the future. Some will say it's dated around 400 rather than 800. And their arguments for both sides seem to be more arguments for the 800, the early dating period. So that's what I have used, 800 to 700 B.C. Some of the reasons Assyria is not mentioned, Egypt and Philistia are, which were powers at that time, no problems with the priesthood, no impending disaster, and certainly they're not criticized heavily for any moral problems. And it is put between Hosea and Amos in the canon. So since it is placed among the early books, the thought is it was an early writing. Tradition also says it was written about that time. Those who say it was late dating say he's dealing in post exilic times because of some terms that are used in the book. We will go with the early date, 800 to 700, before the fall of Judah and before the fall of Israel. That's the dating we will use. As I said, the theme is the day of the Lord. Now, if we want to quickly go through the book, we can say chapter 1 describes a locust plague. Chapter 2 describes the day of the Lord and call to repentance. And chapter 3 is looking back as to why this would happen and then looking forward to the kingdom. And that's your book. Pretty much straightforward, the book of Joel. It was written primarily to the southern kingdom. Several references to Jerusalem and Judah are listed, and certainly areas of Jerusalem and Judah. Chapter 2, verse 1, just give you the references, and verse 23. Chapter 3, verses 1 and 6 refer to Jerusalem and Judah. Locusts are called God's army in the book. Locusts are called God's army. That was nature being used to punish. If we only take it as a historical happening, apparently there had been many locust plagues. Feinberg and Robinson believe you're best to take a literal plague. That Joel is using their remembrance of a literal locust plague coming through as a type of saying, you're going to be punished again by my army. Now, another problem we have where God calls it his army, he calls Assyria the rod of his anger. He does not call the Russians the rod of his anger, or the Oriental hordes. So there's another problem you have. Now, he can use anybody, but specifically in Scripture, he calls the Assyrians the rod of his anger, my army. We'll see he refers to several times my army as we go through here. Locusts are used as God's army. I'll read you some quotes from Feinberg and from Robinson where locusts were actually called God's army. And Arabs literally fear locusts. And they almost reverence them as God's army. We'll also see the descriptions given where the sun and the moon become darkened, that when the locusts flew, they literally did darken the sky. That they were such enormous numbers of them that they literally filled the sky. People have said that when they were flying over, such a clatter like the noise of chariots, and that they literally deposited stuff on the heads of people, the excrement of these locusts were deposited on people underneath them. Everywhere were locusts. We've had some modern plagues in modern time. Here's one. It says, a green plague rakes the West. This was from U.S. News and World Report. It goes on to say, a grasshopper army of near biblical proportions chomped its way through the western states in early summer, doing millions of dollars in damage to the crops of hard-pressed farmers. I believe this was 85. In what many term the worst infestation of the voracious insect in recent memory, grasshoppers were damaging wheat, beans, potatoes, beets, and alfalfa crops, as well as millions of acres of livestock grazing land. There are hundreds of hoppers per square yard, lamented Representative Larry Craig of Idaho, whose family operates a ranch in southern Idaho. They are so thick that the ground rolls and jumps. Looks like the ground is rolling and jumping. Idaho, Utah, Wyoming, Montana were hardest hit in large part because of hot, dry weather that allowed record numbers of grasshopper eggs, to survive. This year, an estimated 95% of them hatched. Just to let you know how awesome locust plagues can be, I'm going to read to you about the locusts. This comes from the Wildlife Encyclopedia, the book that I bought from the college when they were put it up for sale. It's from England. It says, if all locusts in a swarm only 2 miles square were to breed successfully in only 4 generations, there would be a severe infestation of the whole 196 million square miles of the Earth's surface. Just four generations of these hoppers, if all of their breeding were to be successful, if no natural predators came and ate them and so on, they were to breed, they would cover the entire surface of the Earth. Just 2 square miles of them would cover 196 million square miles. He says, fortunately, there is enormous mortality from natural causes. Winds may fail to carry the locusts to a suitable breeding area. Soil may not be moist enough for the eggs to hatch, or they may find insufficient plant growth for their food or to protect them from the heat of the day. There are also many predators, parasites, diseases of locusts, and so on. A little fly lays its eggs on top of it, and then that consumes the locusts before they have a chance. Talks about flocks of birds often accompany both hopper bands and adult swarms, and they can account for an enormous numbers of hoppers. 1,448 hoppers, grasshoppers, were counted in the gut of a single stork. So it consumed over 1,000 of them itself. So if you want to raise storks, instead of bringing babies, you can have them eat the grasshoppers. You want to raise some storks if you ever see a locust plague. They can eat enormous numbers. But they can multiply, and if the circumstances are right, they certainly can do it and cause great havoc. So this is what's used in this particular prophecy of Joel. It apparently harkens back to a literal plague that took place. I have a quote from Ironsides, who has notes, H-I-H-A Ironside, and his notes on the minor prophets says, the immediate circumstances of his testimony seem to be these. The land of Israel, that's the whole land in that sense, had been visited by a terrible plague of locusts which had devoured every green thing, leaving barrenness and famine in their wake. Joel is inspired of God to press home upon the consciences of the nation of Judah the fact that this visitation was from the Lord because of the sin of his people. So he apparently used a literal locust plague in order to illustrate the punishment, the devastation that was going to come upon them. And I'll try to set the background for you by giving you much information about what locusts do, so that when we go through and read the book, which flows pretty easily, we can see what God is going to parallel that with in the armies that he sends upon them. Feinberg says on page 71 on the book, The Minor Prophets, I keep referring to that for the sake of those out in radio land who are listening to me, or taping land, audio tape land, who are listening to me. He talks about it being Joel being one of the earliest of the minor prophets. The last paragraph on page 71, he talks about there's a difference of opinion among students of the book as to whether first part is to be taken as a literal locust plague or to be understood allegorically, he said figuratively, of some future judgment. We must decide for the literal view. An actual locust plague had devastated the land. There are no hints in the text itself that the prophet is using an allegory. The picture given in the prophecy of the locusts is true to their manner of action and to the results of their blighting invasions. The disappearance of the vegetation in the fields, the eating of the bark of woody plants together with the roots under the ground, their swarms darkening the sun, their compact march in military manner, the wind-like noise of their movements, the munching sounds accompanying their eating, all of that is much like an actual locust plague. So because of those vivid, clear descriptions, it is thought that there was an actual locust plague, which now Joel is using in order to try to show what's going to happen. Now, there's no doubt, we come to chapter 2, while he's describing the locusts, that he is also referring to great trouble to come upon them. The day of the Lord is going to bring more than locusts upon the peoples of Israel and Judah. But we have a problem trying to go through and sort it out, because when you have locusts, you have my army, then we have a little bit of a problem there. And we'll see. Notice going down. It said, I have down representing a literal locust plague, an invasion long ago, and an invasion in the day of the Lord. Now, that's clear from the book. Future prophecy shows the first woe is the beast power. That's Revelation 9, first few verses, first five or six verses. Then the second woe is the army of the east, the 200 million strong that God also talks about as such a great army. So when you look at chapter 2, it seems rather clear that's the second army. When you look at chapter 1, you're saying, well, now who is to come against Israel or who is to come against Judah? Is it talking about Babylonians as far as the historical setting, or is it talking about Assyrians who would be a thorn and a plague to Israel before the Russian hordes come against them? Notice I have two possibilities. The first woe, if Joseph is being punished, then the locusts represent the army, the revived Roman Empire at the time of the Great Tribulation. If the second woe, it says, but chapter 2, verse 2 talks about the greatest army ever seen. So if other Israelitish nations are allied with the Roman Empire, then the locusts represent the great army of 200 million Soviets and Orientals at the time of the second woe. The reason we have a problem is because it says, blow the horn in Zion. Blow the horn in Zion. All right, let's go through the prophecies real fast, the prophetic outline of what we have. First of all, we talk about, of course, the pride of Israel, Israel's decay. All right, that we talk about the decay of Israel, the downfall of Israel, economic problems, internal problems, morality problems, pride of the power problems to happen to our modern nations, United States, British Commonwealth countries, which will be then taken into captivity. Secondly, what do we have? Well, then when they're taken into captivity, we have the tribulation. Very difficult period for the world. But what's happening to Israel in the tribulation? Israel's in captivity, right? They will have been decimated. They will have been many, one-third die by famine and pestilence, one-third die by sword, one-third taken into captivity. So during the tribulation period, they're already punished. Now, then you have heavenly signs. Which signal what? The day of the Lord. When God is going to say, wait a minute now, here are the heavenly signs, get your attention, and now I'm going to punish you. You earth, you peoples who are rebellious, who are actively fighting against my peoples and actively fighting against me. So you have the heavenly signs preceding the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord then includes seven trumpet plagues, right? The last three of the trumpet plagues are called the three woes. Trumpet 5 is first woe, trumpet 6 is second woe, and trumpet 7 is the third woe. The seventh trumpet brings what? Seven last plague. So what we're saying is, blow the horn in Zion, Joel 2 verse 1. Blow the horn in Zion and tell them they're going to get theirs now. What Zion is this referring to? Is this referring to Israel, you're going to get yours? Is this referring to Israel, whoever is aligned with the beast power, you're going to get yours? That's where we have the difficulty in saying, where does this fit? Because it can't, if it's talking about Israel in general, the modern day, let's say, our peoples, they're already in captivity. Why do you want to blow the horn? They've already been decimated and suffering as slaves to this beast power.
The other problem is the beast power, as we mentioned before, is identified in Revelation 9 as locusts. In Isaiah 10 and 11, it's called my army, God's army. Here we find locusts called God's army. So does chapter 1 refer to God's army coming against them initially, the beast power here, the day when God deals with them? Or are we talking literal, this literal specific day of the Lord time rather than the general day of the Lord, the specific day of the Lord? And is it over here talking about the second woe? Now, the church's booklet, the teaching on it, and I think if you check, somebody wants to do more research, you probably will find where Joel, the beginning of Joel, is likened to the very first woe. But the church's teaching, according to Revelation Unveiled at Last, is that the second woe is what is being spoken of in Joel chapter 2. Joel 2:4, the reference to the greatest army. We will see as we go through and read it, it doesn't seem to flow so easily in that area. And this is where you will have the problem. Wait a minute now. So it's good for you to have an outline of what's going to be happening at the end times so you can keep your attention down here. Now, no doubt, historically, he's talking about the day when the Assyrians will come against the northern kingdom, which hadn't fallen yet, and when the Babylonians would come against the southern kingdom, since the southern kingdom is the main focus of this prophecy. But he's also talking of the day of the Lord, the end time, when all peoples are going to receive his spirit. It's very clear he's talking about the end time. We'll even see many millennial scriptures talking about when he brings them back from captivity to their northern neighbor, see. So we'll see that as we go along. One other possibility about blowing the horn in Zion, it could be the time when both the Assyrian power, or the beast power, and the Oriental powers, the first woe and the second woe, are fighting over Jerusalem. So it could be a literal, blow that horn in Zion, because there are going to come great troubles to this burdensome stone that Jerusalem is called. So there are several possibilities mixed in here, and I'll try to clarify it as much as I can for you. But I want to make you aware, this book is not easy to understand prophetically because of the symbolism that's used. The symbolism of the locust is also used specifically for the symbolism of the beast power. Therefore, if you equate the locusts of Joel with the locusts of Revelation, uh-oh. Now, what do you do with these locusts when you take them into chapter 2? When this is the second woe, the Oriental hordes coming against Jerusalem or Zion. So that's where we have a little bit of difficulty in it. But if you keep this in mind, the order of prophetical events, then you'll be able to better know. Israel was already in captivity, so it can't be referring to them. So in chapter 2, what Israel would be referred to? Either whatever Israel was aligned with the beast power. What nations of Western Europe will still be in the beast power? As Dr. Hay feels that one toe, or one side, remember it's got the ten toes, 2 feet of iron and miry clay. One is this way, one is that. We figure maybe one is East Europe and one is Western Europe. Will those in Western Europe include some Israelitish nations? So that you could say, blow the horn in Zion, Zion being a type of the high hill, the holy hill of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, remember, was the capital of all of Israel at one time. So blow the horn in Zion, not just for the Jews. Blow the horn in Zion because tell those Israelites they're going to suffer who've thrown in with the beast power and fought against my people, the ones upon whom I named Israel's name. So if that's what it is, then that's clear down here. We still have a problem, though, with understanding locusts. Still have a problem if you're saying, well, locusts are identified in Scripture as the beast power. Unless we say, wait a minute. Here we find a locust plague. Locusts are merely being used as a showing devastation is going to come. And don't try to align the word locust with any particular nation, except to say locusts are being used as a symbol of devastation.
that God is prophesying against the peoples of the southern kingdom here, and of course against all of Israel in a larger sense. So I hope that gives you, at least by knowing the outline of prophecy, you'll be better able to deal with it as we go through. But I wanted you to know it's not without problems trying to understand it because of some of the terminology that is used. That's about all I'll give you from here. The invasion, the historical invasion, was likely that of Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldeans from the north. That was likely. And of course, Joel 2:4 then is likely referring to the second woe, the communist hordes who were to come against the beast power, who were probably occupying the Jerusalem area. Page 71 on Feinberg talks about the devastation of these locusts. Covered that already with you. Four different words are used on page 72. Page 72, the second paragraph says, the four names in verse 4, meaning literally the gnawer, G-N-A-W-E-R, the swarmer, or multiplier, the licker, that's the third category, and the consumer, have been taken to mean either four types of locusts or four stages of growth in the case of one type of locust. It says, note that the King James Version, the Authorized, and the American Standard Version translate these three Hebrew words alike. Neither view is tenable, for the prophet uses the common word for locust and then gives three poetic equivalents. So the thought is, here are the locusts, and here's what they would do, that one locust, what it would do in different stages, is the thought. Locusts have been rightly called the incarnation of hunger. Listen what they can do. This is the last paragraph before the words fearsome plague on page 72. They have been known to devour over an area of almost 90 miles every green herb, every blade of grass, so that the ground gave the appearance of having been scorched by fire. The locusts have a scorched earth policy of their own. Joel's description of the plague has been confirmed by many accounts of locust devastations. So here you find these locusts that just go through and devour almost anything. Page 76 and 77 describes the locust plague and what they do on the march. The reason I'm taking so much time with this is because when we read Joel chapter 1 and 2, we say, hey, that sounds just like a locust plague. And it does. You're saying, hey, if you people remembered, there was a locust plague that came through here. Pages 76 and 77 says, the record now paints for us an eyewitness account of what ruin the drought and the locust accomplished in the land. The drought was as the consuming fire that leaves all the scorched earth, all scorched in its trail. And with the locusts, what was as the Garden of Eden before they descended upon the land was now nothing more than a desolate wilderness. Nothing escapes the devastating blight. Now follows an accurate description of locusts in their march, an account unexcelled in all the realm of literature. The locusts are likened, first of all, to horses. In fact, the head of a locust is so like the horse that the Italians call it cavalletti. A cavalletti means a little horse. Germans speak of locusts as Heupferde. Hay horses, is how it describes them. They not only look like horses, but they have the speed of a war horse. Noise accompanies all their movements. Noise is when chariots jostle in their running. Noise is when the fire licks up the dried stubble. Noise is when the strong host is being mustered to the conflict. Page 77, top of the page. the noise of the wings of the locusts in motion and of their hind legs strikes terror in every heart. In the life of every member of the nation, this visitation will linger in memory. Locusts are as tireless in their running as mighty men. And we'll notice that when we go through chapter 2. It'll say, like mighty men, like this, like that. It doesn't say these are mighty men, these are this. It says like. So he's describing a locust plague, but talking about the devastation that's going to come upon their land as a result of armies invading their land. We'll see, it's a very clear description. I remember years ago, one of the ministers trying to explain how they march on and they don't break their ranks. And I remember saying, well, maybe there was some type of nerve gas, they weren't killed, or maybe they just kept on marching though they were stunned or something. These men have this superhuman power. And it wasn't that. It's just that those locusts are so anxious to keep on marching that they, if one is killed or drops out, the other just fills right in the ranks and keeps on going. It's as if it was never there in the first place. They just keep on marching. And I'll read you another description of it in a moment. It says they're tireless, running as men of war. They appear to have their regulated flanks like an army on the march. They are adept at scaling walls as though directed by a mastermind. They don't break their ranks. No one thrusts another out of its place. All is in turmoil and confusion at their onslaught. The heavenly bodies themselves are darkened by the thick masses of locusts flying under the whole expanse of heavens. Now, the literal locust plague he's describing, you could say the sun and the moon became dark. Now, we know that it isn't just going to be locusts that darken the sun and the moon. God is going to do that as well. Destruction is literally on the march, for as thieves the locusts seek out what they may devour. But the Lord himself is in all of this as well. He utters his voice, the thunderstorm, for his great army of locusts. They are his army, in a real sense, because they are both powerful and numerous. One of the laws of Muhammad reads, quote, "You shall not kill the locusts, for they are the army of God Almighty." So being a fate-oriented people, they looked upon the locusts as something coming upon them because of their evil doing. The command of God is being executed by his instruments. I also want to read to you a couple of comments from Robinson, pages 32 and 33, by Robinson, where he talks about the successive orders. He talks about them being on page 33. This is the book entitled The 12 Minor Prophets by Robinson. He says, when the insects are fully developed, they're about 2.5 inches long, their heads resembling horses. And he goes on to quote the same thing. And in fact, they do resemble flying fighters. They do climb over walls and enter homes and make the air to quiver. They have been estimated to fly at a rate of 12 miles an hour. They can move pretty fast for being a little small creature. On page 34, the bottom of the page, he says, he describes an account, an actual eyewitness account of a plague in 1915. He testifies that in less than 2 months after their first appearance, not only was every green leaf devoured, but the very bark was peeled from the trees, which stood out white and lifeless like skeletons. Can you imagine? Locusts, grasshopper, can actually go through and devour bark off of trees, every blade of grass, every shred of vegetation. Have any of you been in a locust plague or around a locust plague, witnessed the locust plague? Manuel, how was it? Just total devastation. They had to pay they commanded, they had a law back in Israel that they had to go out and bring in so many pounds of eggs, grasshopper eggs. Each person every day had to go out and bring in so many pounds of eggs. I'm trying to see where that is. I'll find it before I'm finished. In order to stop the great plague that came upon the Judean or the modern Israel area. Trying to see where that quote is here. I'll find it for you. I don't see it right now, but I'll I'll pick it up. All right, let's go on and read this continued account of an actual plague. He says, the fields were stripped to the ground. Even Arab babies left by their mothers in the shade of some tree had their faces devoured before their screams were heard. The natives accepted the plague as a just judgment upon them for their wickedness. But even babies being out in the field had their faces devoured when they marched through. This book shows a locust plague. I don't know if you can see the black in the sky that darkens it are locusts flying and swarming. And they have different tactics. They march and they swarm, different phases of it where they're actually flying, other cases where they just march along. It also shows an area where they're marching. It says the desert locust presents a real international problem, which is yet to be solved. They go on and show the different phases of it. It shows the immature period. It says the immature pink adult female, it shows her. Millions of these exist in vast swarms which follow the wind to arrive in new breeding grounds soon after rain. Most damage is done in this migratory period. Crops are eaten entirely. Trees are broken by the weight of these settling locusts. Can you imagine enough locusts in a tree that breaks the branches? Here's a close-up of the yellow and black hopper. It says, while the hoppers are marching, they have a daily routine based on temperature. So here's what they do. At sunrise, they descend from their roosts in low vegetation, and they lie and warm up in the sun, store up some energy. Once their bodies are at working temperature, they march until the ground heat of midday forces them to climb into another roost and resume the journey in the afternoon. It says, while, quote, snack bar eating occurs en route, the main meal is taken in the early evening. Then it shows the menace to come. It just shows a wide path that these locusts are going. Hopper bands on the march, eating all the way. They just march along, munching and eating. Whoever the first one missed, the second one gets, or the third one, or the 100th, or the 9,000th one gets. It says they hop for up to a mile a day in their latter stages. It goes on to show some of the different breeding habits, how much they could lay and what they could do. I'm trying to see if I can pick out that other quote for you. No, I don't see it right now. I'll pick it out. It talks about the desert locust is the locust of the Bible and now by far the most damaging of all. It is hard to control because it has no geographically determined outbreak area. They really don't know when to expect it to break out and why it's going to break out. If you want to look at some of these pictures afterwards, I'd be happy to show them to you. All right, let's see if I want any other information I want to give to you. He calls them his army. The day of the Lord is mentioned 5 times in the book. We've covered that already. Let's take one quick look at Revelation 9 so you can see where, as I mentioned, where the problem exists. We find Joel speaking about the locusts. Let's look at Revelation chapter 9. Revelation 9 and verse 1 says, the fifth angel sounded. Of course, the fifth angel is the same as the first woe. The fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven to the earth. To him was given the key of the bottomless pit. So an angel came down. Bible talks about an angel being like a star. He was given to him of the bottomless pit, or the abyss. And he opened the bottomless pit, or this huge abyss, and there arose the smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and to them was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. It was commanded that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months, just a long period of time. Their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he strikes a man. And it says, in those days shall men seek death and shall not find it, shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them, because of the torment they'll inflict. Verse 7. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared for battle, on their heads as it were crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men. They had hair as the hair of women, their teeth were as the teeth of lions. So again, we see the locusts being described. It talked about their tails, and many comments have been made about this. Remember, John was trying to describe what he saw in the future in the language of his day. And he'd never had seen a helicopter. How would you describe a helicopter that came overhead? It was breathing fire and maybe the whirly bird over top, and you saw the tail in the back spinning. How would you describe it if it had rockets on it? And if you could even see the eyes of the copter pilot as he came close enough, what would you think of it? Or it had two big windows from a distance that looked even like, and maybe it had been decorated a little bit, as some of the planes, you know, the PSA jet plane has a little smile on it. Maybe this had a frown on it and looked at it and teeth drawn to make it look ugly, as many World War II pilots had their planes decorated. So whatever he's seeing here, he's describing as a locust, though. So if you say this locust is equal to the locust of Joel, you've got a problem. But in going on to the sixth trumpet, verse 13 says, one woe is past, two more to go. Verse 13 says, the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates, which he was holding back. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, a day, a month, a year, for to slay the third part of men. Great trouble on the earth. Verse 16, and the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000, or 200 million. 200 million man army. And I heard the number of them. Now, I don't know how many men the United States has in arms now, but it'd be 9 million, somewhere like 9, 10 million in under arms, and certainly they have many other who are reservists who could go up. But I don't think it's much more than 9 or 10 million in arms. And most nations don't have 200 million man armies, so we would feel that this would probably be the Oriental hordes in conjunction with the communist power of Russia, who are going to come against the beast power who will have struck first. So here you have this huge army, and he said he saw the horses in vision and so on. And they were going to kill a third part of men. He describes them and their powers in their mouth and in their tails. Tails were like serpents, they had heads. Doesn't describe them as locusts. So if you're stuck with, whoa, wait a minute, here's locusts over here, let's apply locust to locust, then you go to the first woe. But Joel chapter 2, the indication is the greatest army would be this second one, and certainly that's the way we understand it in our literature. Awesome army. All right, let's go to the book of Joel chapter 1. Let's go to the book of Joel. There's very little known about him as a person. There are several other Joels mentioned in the Bible. Once again, just because you read the name Joel, it doesn't mean it's Joel the minor prophet. Other than him being a son of Pethuel, not a whole lot is known about Joel. Joel chapter 1, remember his name means Yahweh is God. Yahweh or Jehovah is God. He was a prophet of Judah to the southern kingdom primarily. Theme is the day of the Lord and coming judgment. Verse 4, that which the palmer worm has left, the locust has the locust eaten. And that which the locust has left has the canker worm eaten. And that which the canker worm has left has the caterpillar eaten. So four stages of development, or four different types of locusts. I would say four stages of the same locust. Verse 5, awake, you drunkards, and weep and howl. Those of you who like to drink, those of you who spend too much time at the bottle, you're not going to be too happy, because you're not going to have any grapes to make wine with. You're not going to have any grain to make booze with. You're not going to have any figs to make liqueur with. So you're going to have a rough time. You better get up and pay attention. You drunkards, weep and howl, all you drinkers of wine, because of the new wine, for it is cut off from your mouth. It's cut off from their mouth because there won't be any crop. Verse 6, for a nation is come upon my land, strong and without number. Is come up is a military term used for military invasion. Is come up is a military term used for military invasion. And notice he says, is come up upon my land. Which land is known as God's land? Israel. Now, if he's talking just geographically, it would be Palestine, the Middle East. If he's talking my land, my peoples, wherever they are, wherever I've given Israel land, it would be an invasion of any of his peoples. I would say historically, naturally, it's talking about what was going to happen when Nebuchadnezzar invaded Judah, the southern kingdom. He goes on to say, this nation, or a people, or a group, a nation has come up upon my land, strong and without number, whose teeth are as the teeth of a lion, and he has the cheek teeth of a great lion. He can devour, he can chew up, he can chew you up and spit you out. Verse 7, he's laid my vine waste, my vine. Who is God's vine? All you need to do is check Isaiah 5 and verse 7. God talks about Israel. Israel was his vine. Now, Judah was part of Israel, wasn't it? It was one of the tribes of Israel. It was the southern part of Israel, if we're talking historically, specifically. We're talking generally, God saying, Israel is going to suffer problems. Israel is going to be taken over. Israel is going to be taken into captivity. If we're talking generally, we're talking tribulation period right now. He has laid my vine waste and barked my fig tree. Remember we talked about what they would do, devour every bit of vegetation, even the bark on the trees. He's made it clean bare and cast it away. The branches thereof are made white. An actual description of a plague they did. They stripped it white, took the bark off the trees, standing out there like skeletons in the field. Lament like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. What would it be like to lose your husband or wife when you were just newly married? One of the saddest funerals I ever did was the funeral for a couple that had been married just over a year. The woman was pregnant and expecting their very first child, which the husband never lived to see. He had cancer of the testicle, and it spread so fast. I think he knew about it in April, March or April, and he was dead. I think it was somewhere, maybe he knew about it. Sorry, I take that back. Knew about it about January, February, and he was dead. I believe it was just beyond or during the days of unleavened bread. It didn't last long. He tried, going down. My wife and I went up and visited them in their home. They had even invited us up for dinner because their marriage was performed on the same day we were married, the end of June. And it was just barely a year and a half or whatever they had been married. And she was expecting, he knew she was expecting their first child. And he died. And that was so sad. And it said, you better get ready to be sad like a new bride, a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. This woman who just barely married. Or maybe the guy wasn't even married to her. Maybe he was promised. She were still a virgin. How sad. Get ready to cry and weep. You know, when people have lived together for many years and had a fairly long life, it's always sad to see somebody die. But when they die so soon after marriage, it really is a sad time. He says, you better get ready. Verse 9, the meat offering and the drink offering is cut off from the house of the Lord. Why won't they be able to have any meat or drink offerings? Nothing to offer. No meal, no drink. How can they offer it? Because this plague is going to be so complete. The priests, the Lord's ministers, mourn. Sure, they don't have anything to offer. The field is wasted. The land mourns, for the corn is wasted. The new wine is dried up. The oil languishes. The olive oil is no longer available. Be ashamed, you farmers, and howl, O you vine dressers, for the wheat, for the barley, because the harvest of the field is perished. The vine is dried up, the fig tree languishes, the pomegranate tree, the palm tree also, the apple tree, even all the trees of the field are withered, because joy is withered away from the sons of men. Because mankind, the way he's done, the way he's lived, and also all these things have withered, mankind doesn't have any happiness or joy to go along with it. The land is dried up. God will protect his people. But if they don't live right, he says, all of you are going to be affected, the farmers and everyone else. Verse 13, gird yourselves and lament, you priests. Howl, you ministers of the altar. Come lie all night in sackcloth, you ministers of my God, for the meal offering and the drink offering is withheld from the house of your God. You're not going to be able to perform your duties. Howl, lament. They should also howl and lament because they didn't teach God's people God's way. They didn't teach God's people the knowledge and the truth. He says, sanctify a fast. Call a solemn assembly. Gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land into the house of the Lord. Into the house of the Lord your God, rather, and cry to the Lord. And no sacrifices left. The only thing to do is fast. Pray for all men during a fast. We have the Day of Atonement coming up. Do you realize that when we fast on the Day of Atonement, we're really not fasting for ourselves as far as the plan of God is concerned? As far as the plan of God is concerned, after the Feast of Trumpets, you're changed to a spirit being. If God was only concerned about us, he could quit the plan of God after the Feast of Trumpets. You have been turned to a spirit being. That's your birthday, when you'll be born again into the family of God. So why are you fasting on the Day of Atonement? Fasting on the Day of Atonement is picturing a group of people drawing closer to God from all over the world to come together in unity, to draw nearer to their Creator and their Maker. You and I have the privilege of picturing a world coming at one with God. When they will finally look up and say, there's my Lord, when they will recognize God. So Day of Atonement is a beautiful time because it's not for you, though it helps you get ready for the feast, helps you lose a little weight, though it does help you get ready for the feast in a spiritual way, though it's always good to fast and draw closer to God, it's really, as far as the plan of God, not for you. It's for you to picture other people, the peoples of this world, finally getting close to God. It's a beautiful part of the plan of God. As far as you making it into the kingdom, hey, it's already finished on trumpets. We could have four feast days. Finish it there. As far as you, but God cares about the world too. The Day of Atonement, you're fasting to picture a world becoming at one with God. Feast of Tabernacles, you're picturing a beautiful world for mankind. You already have it made. You're a spirit being in the family of God as of the Day of Trumpets. But the Feast of Tabernacles, picturing a world happy and joyous, under the rulership of God. The last great day, what happens to all these people that have lived and died and never knew anything? They're going to come up in a resurrection. So really, the rest of the feast days after trumpet is because God wants the world included in his plan, not just for you and me individually. So he says, sanctify a fast. Cry to God. Maybe God will hear. Maybe God will change his mind. If you cry to him and repent, and you can fast for all the wrong reasons, Isaiah 58 says, if you can fast and then mistreat your brother, if you can fast and then not help people, if you can fast and not care about the poor, then that fast is for nothing. It's just selfish. Fasting is for us to draw closer to God so we can be like God in our practice, in our habit, in our manner of living. All right, I'll stop there and let you take about a minute's break to stand stretch for them to gather. This was from the plague in 1915 in Jerusalem. And it says, the government issued a proclamation in April 1915 requiring every man from 16 to 60 years of age to gather 11 pounds of locust eggs. As far as I understand, locust eggs aren't very big. Every man had to gather 11 pounds of locust eggs daily. Not weekly, daily. And deliver them to the officials. The stork, which Arabs call Abu Sa'ad, the father of good luck, was especially numerous over Palestine in 1915 and greedily devoured the innumerable host of the locust pest. Hens gorged themselves on the pest. Just so you could know, it's from Robinson's book. I had forgotten where I had found that. And I knew I had seen it somewhere. 11 pounds of eggs daily shows you how much they were outputting as far as the reproduction and breeding was concerned. All right, Joel chapter 1 and verse 15. So he just told them, all this is going to happen to you, you drunkards, you farmers, you priests, you better start howling because it's going to affect you. And of course, military invasion also doesn't look after the vegetation. You drop bombs and other means of conventional warfare and you leave a scorched trail. Verse 15, alas for the day. Alas for the day of the Lord is at hand. Now, if we want to apply this historically, it means the day when God deals with you. Your day is coming. The day when God deals with you. The day when Nebuchadnezzar is going to come romping through your land and take you into captivity. If you want to apply it to the northern kingdom, the day when the Assyrians come through and take you into captivity. Alas for the day, for the day of the Lord is at hand. Now, how could it have been at hand back then? It couldn't have, as far as this specific one. But it means the day of the Lord is coming. The day when God reckons with you is coming. And as a destruction from the Almighty shall it come. Is not the meat cut off before our eyes? The meat or the meal, they're not going to be able to have any more food. Joy and gladness from the house of our God. How do you keep a feast without any food? The seed is rotten under their clods. The garners are laid waste. The barns are broken down, for the corn is withered. There's nothing, nothing left. Pictures the day of the Lord occurring. Verse 18, how do the beasts groan? The herds of cattle are perplexed. How come you don't have any hay for me? Where's my feed? Where's my grain? Because they have no pasture. Yea, the flocks of sheep are made desolate. The animals are going to be questioned. What's going on here? O Lord, to you will I cry. Imagine the animals, the fright when the actual day of the Lord comes, when the armies invade, when there's military warfare. I mean, my dog goes bananas over the 4th of July with firecrackers. Imagine what the animals will be like when the war, when the bombs hit, when the warfare takes place. He says, O Lord, verse 19, to you will I cry, for the fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness. Fire as a result of a literal locust plague, yes, but also fire as a result of military invasion. And the flame has burned all the trees of the field. The beasts of the field cry also to you, for the rivers of water are dried up. The fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness. So you could say chapter 1, in summary, is describing a locust plague to come upon them. Remember Ezekiel 5 and verse 12? One-third of our country is to die with famine and pestilence. Pestilence including the drought and the diseases that ensue when you don't have proper nutrition and sanitation and water supply. Chapter 2. Chapter 2 also talks about the locust plague. Chapter 2 talks about the locust plague. What's going to happen? And how they actually transpire. This is the devastation, chapter 1. Chapter 2 talks about the plague. But it also talks about the day of the Lord. Notice verse 1. Blow you the trumpet in Zion. Now why does he say blow a warning message in Zion? Why should he warn Israel? Why should he warn Judah? Because the literal problem was going to affect them. The historical situation was going to affect them. Also in the future. If we're talking about the Oriental hordes the communist power, the communist bloc, to come against the beast power, who will have already planted its tabernacles in the Jerusalem area. That could be literal. But also those various nations which had thrown in with the beast power. Right now you have a number of, quote, Israelitish countries, unquote. You have a number of them, the French and the English and Belgium and some of these countries. I'm not sure if Switzerland's in that alignment or not. You have a number of them in Europe, Denmark and some of those, who are considered Israelitish countries. Is God saying, blow the horn, let them know. Let those know who are outside of Joseph that they're going to suffer. Let them know that something's going to come upon them. Certainly the literal area of Jerusalem is talked about as being the final battle, where Jesus Christ is going to have to come back and stop the world powers that exist at his return from blowing themselves up and the whole world with them. Blow the trumpet in Zion. The trumpet is a sound of alarm. Blow the trumpet in Zion. Sound an alarm in my holy mountain. My holy mountain, God says. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord comes. The day of the Lord is coming, for it is near at hand. Now, when Joel wrote, the obvious meaning was, the Chaldeans are going to come upon you, the Assyrians are going to come upon you. That was clear for the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom, respectively. But if you take it to the literal day of the Lord, it would have to be applying to those nations which were aligned with the beast power, or the Judean area, the peoples in and around Judea. Blow the horn there because great trouble is coming. Notice verse 2, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, as the morning spread upon the mountains, a great people and a strong. There has not been ever the like. Now this is why we feel as a church, this is why we feel this has to be the second woe. Because there's no other army described in the Bible this great as the communist hordes, the 200 million man army. There has not ever been the like, neither shall there be any more after it. That's Revelation 9, verse 16. Even to the years of many generations, they'll never see anything like this. So if you apply it to a military army, the only one it could be Revelation 9, verse 16. A fire devours before them, and behind them a flame burns. So they leave it totally devastated. Where they go, and after them comes a fire. It's nothing but scorched earth. The land is as the Garden of Eden before them. Looks really nice before them. And behind them, it's a desolate wilderness. Yea, nothing shall escape them. Now he's describing what this marching army of locusts would do. He's also describing the devastation that God's going to wreak upon the Israelites because of their disobedience to him and their lack of turning to him. Their lack of moral fiber and strength. Nothing shall escape them. Verse 4, the appearance of them is as the appearance of horses. And as horsemen, so shall they run. One comparison, I believe, in Revelation 9, verses 16, 17, and 18, it also mentions that second power was as horsemen. Yeah, Revelation 9, 16, the number of the army of the horsemen. So here is a similarity to them, as horsemen. The appearance of them is as the appearance of horses. Remember we talked about how the little locusts were called the cavalletti in Italian, hoip verta in German. The appearance of them is as the appearance of horses. As horsemen, so shall they run swiftly. Like a noise of chariots on the tops of the mountains shall they leap. Remember their hoppers and jump around. They like the noise of a flame of fire that devours the stubble, this crackling sound, as they devour the food and devour the vegetation. As a strong people set in battle array. Notice, before their face the people shall be much pained. All faces shall gather blackness. When you see this plague, you'll look and you'll be stunned. Total blank look. No joy, no happiness, no brightness, no beaming because of seeing them. They shall run like mighty men. They shall climb the wall like men of war. See, he's describing the literal locust plague, but he's saying they're like what's going to come to pass. They shall march every one on his ways. They shall not break their ranks. Follow each other in military fashion. They shall thrust one. Neither shall one thrust another. They'll be well organized. They shall walk every one in his path where he's supposed to go. And when they shall fall upon the sword, they shall not be wounded. Now, how can you fall on a sword and not be wounded? In other words, no power can stop them. They cannot be hindered. They cannot be stopped because there are so many of them and they are so great, they just keep on coming. Someone once said that if you marched the great Oriental armies into the sea, that there are enough in China, there are enough men who are being born every day and so on, that if you just marched them at a normal rate, you could just keep marching them into the sea almost endlessly. That's how many men they could have if they needed to use them. Because then somebody else turns 18, they go into the army, they form the back of the line. These others go in, others are turning 18, they're joining the army. And so on, because of so many people. That's a mighty army. This army, 200 million, is also a mighty army. He goes on to say in verse 9, they shall run to and fro in the city. They shall run upon the wall. They shall climb up upon the houses. They shall enter in at the windows like a thief. And apparently, feeling is when they come, they just go everywhere. Everywhere. Whatever's in their path. They shall enter into the windows like a thief. The earth shall quake before them. The heavens shall tremble. The sun and moon shall be dark. And the stars shall withdraw their shining. I'll stop there. And well, let's read verse 11. And the Lord shall utter his voice before his army, for his camp is very great. He's strong that executes his word, for the day of the Lord is great and very terrible. Who can abide it? When God gets ready to deal with you, Israel, Judah, when God gets ready to deal with you in the future, he's great. His army will do what he wants them to do. Now, we can look at Isaiah 13 and see that God calls the Assyrians his army. He talks about what will happen in Isaiah 13 and verses 12 through 16. He talks about what's going to happen there. That isn't the one that I wanted, by the way. Let's see if I can find it over here. Yes. Isaiah 10:5 calls the Assyrian the rod of his anger. So, his army to punish Israel initially would be the Assyrians. His army to punish the Israelites who are aligned with the beast power will be the communist hordes. His army. My army, God says, they will do it. Who is going to be able to abide? All right, we'll stop there. Pick it up next time. We should finish the book of Joel.